Okay. All right. Welcome everyone back. Happy July 4th. We will be continuing with our series on the Rambam's introduction to Mishnah. In honor of July 4th, American Independence Day, I decided to go a little bit out of order. We're going to focus on a part of the Rambam, which is at the end of his introduction. It's connected to what we did last week, as well as previous weeks before that. And it has to do with something that I guess really touches at the cornerstone of one of the main arguments that the Americans had when they decided to break away from the British. It is probably best connected to something that Thomas Paine wrote in Common Sense, I believe. I'm going to try to share that with you. Give me one second here. Sorry, it's not in Common Sense. It's in The Rights of Man. Let me just make that a little bit bigger. There we go. Okay, just before we begin, also I wanted to apologize. I did not realize, I was misinformed about when the Macy's fireworks start. I thought they started at 8, not 9:25 or 9:30. So I'm going to try to see what I can do to wrap things up around 9:30, if we don't get through everything, we'll God willing finish it next week. So with that in mind, let's begin. So Thomas Paine, he wrote a number of works of literature that were distributed amongst the British colonies in the United States, and he really spoke to the common person, to the common man, trying to craft arguments to inspire and legitimize breaking away from the colonies. And one of the arguments to sort of justify why we were allowed to break away is because we are no longer bound by the pledges of loyalty that our ancestors gave. So let me read you an excerpt. In source number 9, in The Rights of Man, part 1, Thomas Paine wrote, "The Parliament or the people of 1688 or of any other period had no more right to dispose of the people of the present day or to bind or to control them in any shape whatever than the Parliament or the people of the present day have to dispose of, bind, or control those who are to live 100 or 1,000 years hence. On what ground of right, then, could the Parliament of 1688 or any other parliament bind all posterity forever?" So this was being written several hundred, about 100 years, a little less than that, probably about 80, maybe 90 years before the American Revolution started, this event in 1688. I'm not sure exactly when Rights of Man was published, but it was before 1776. And Thomas Paine said that in 1688, the Parliament in the British government and the American colonists agreed that the colonies in America would be loyal subjects to the British crown and would accept the law of the king and the law of Parliament. So one might argue then that because there was an agreement in 1688, then even in 1776, people, the descendants of the people that made those agreements, could not break them, could not break away. And Thomas Paine said, that's ridiculous. Parliament or the people in 1688 have no right to legislate something on a future generation, just like our present generation does not have the right to legislate for people hundreds or thousands of years into the future. And he continues, "It requires but a very small glance of thought to perceive that although laws made in one generation often continue in force through succeeding generations," so he acknowledges that obviously there are numerous examples of laws that are made in one generation and continue to have an impact in future generations and to be legally binding. However, he says, they continue to derive their force from the consent of the living. The fact and the reason why laws that were passed hundreds of years ago are legally binding is not because of anything or any power that existed when they were made, but in each generation, we perpetually reaffirm and consent to those laws. A law not repealed continues in force, not because it cannot be repealed, but because it is not repealed. And the non-repealing passes for consent. So to sum up, what Thomas Paine argued is that the Americans, or anybody for that matter, should not be bound by a law or an agreement that was made hundreds of years before that. Rather, each generation reaffirms whatever agreements were made in the past, if they like them. And if they don't like them, they have the authority and power to overturn them. And therefore, Thomas Paine said, the American colonists were perfectly, it was perfectly within their right to break away, despite the fact that their ancestors and the ancestors in the British in the British mainland, in Parliament, had all agreed that the American colonies would be loyal subjects of the British crown forever. And the reason is because our present generation, Thomas Paine said, we don't want to do that anymore. So we're just going to overturn it. So this concept that Thomas Paine took for granted, that a law cannot be legally binding for future generations unless the present generation agrees to it, is something that has a lot of ramifications for Torah in the broad sense, and for Halacha and Gemara in particular. And that's what we're going to be focusing on today in an excerpt from the Rambam's introduction to Mishnah, which is why the Gemara is legally binding on all future generations. And we'll kind of touch back on what we discussed in previous classes to realize that that is not something that should necessarily be logical or obvious. So if you ask the average Orthodox Jew nowadays, you would say, obviously the Gemara is legally binding. The Shulchan Aruch is the final authority on Jewish law, and all of those conclusions are taken from the Talmud. The Talmud is the legally binding arbiter or the final voice in Jewish law. But as we'll see, according to the Rambam, even though the Rambam himself says that, that shouldn't necessarily be the case. So let's start off in source number one with the Rambam's introduction to Mishnah. So what we had done last week was we had continued with the narrative that the Rambam described of how Rabbi Yehuda Hanasi collected and edited the Mishnah, and then how a couple hundred years later, Ravina and Rav Ashi collected teachings that were meant to explain the Mishnah, and they collected them to form the Gemara. And we had also discussed how the Rambam, as well as many other Sephardic Rishonim, medieval rabbis, were of the opinion that Rabbi Yehuda Hanasi was the actual author of the text of the Mishnah. He wrote it down. And Ravina and Rav Ashi were the authors of the actual text. They wrote down the Gemara. We pointed out, however, that that is not something that it is universally accepted both by academic scholars as well as rabbis. At least on the rabbinic side of the debate, it really traces itself back to a letter that was written by Rav Sharira Gaon. Rav Sharira Gaon was one of the later heads of the yeshiva in Bavel, in, I guess, modern-day Iraq, during the Islamic Caliphate. And he sent letters describing the evolution of Torah Sheba'al Peh, of the oral law. And we have two versions of this letter. The French version actually says that Rabbi Yehuda Hanasi did not write the Mishnah, and Ravina and Rashi did not write it. Rather, they collected it. They organized it. And they may have even created a text for it, but it wasn't written down. It was oral. It was written down in later generations. That was pretty much the opinion of most Ashkenazic rabbis because that is the text that they had. Most of the Sephardic rabbis, and there are exceptions on both sides, most of the Sephardic rabbis, though, had the Spanish version. And the Spanish version actually says explicitly that Rav Yehuda Hanasi wrote down the Mishnah and Ravina and Rav Ashi wrote down the Gemara. Either way, though, both versions agree that the material, the tochen, not the actual words or the written text, but the tochen, the substance of the Gemara, was completed by Ravina and Rav Ashi. That's a, I guess, overgeneralization. There we're probably, the Rambam doesn't mention this, maybe the Rambam didn't know, but there are many attestations in other parts of rabbinic literature, including this letter that I mentioned to you from Rav Sharira Gaon, as well as we have manuscripts nowadays that attest to this, that for the next 250 years or so, there were subsequent edits by this little known era in Jewish scholarship called the Savoraim, which are known as which comes from the word svara, understanding or logic or reasoning. And their job was not to innovate, but was to kind of add elaborations to the Gemara. But regardless, the main corpus of the text of the Talmud, and especially the halachic decisions, were completed by Ravin and Rav Ashi. So the Rambam continues, U'kishemesu kol hachachamim aleim hashalom, she'achron mehem Ravina v'Rav Ashi, v'Talmud kvar nigmar, when all of the sages in the times of the Talmud passed away, concluding with Ravin and Rav Ashi, the Talmud was already finished. V'chol asher kam acharav, Haisa tachlis kavanaso v'chol me'odo lahavin divrehem shekasvu bilvad. The entire goal and energy of everybody in all future generations who came after the completion of the Talmud was only to understand and explain the words that they wrote. V'alav ein lehosif umimenu ein ligroa. And one cannot add or take away from the Talmud. Essentially, you cannot argue with the Talmud. You can have debates as to what the decision is in the Talmud. You can dispute how to understand the Talmud, but you cannot argue with the decision in the Talmud. And the Rambam doesn't say where he gets this from. It could just be historical record. But there's a piece in the Gemara which pretty much says this. In source number 2, the Gemara in Bava Metzia says, Ravina and Rav Ashi sof hora'ah, that Ravina and Rav Ashi are the end of legal rulings. There's various ways to understand what that means, but the simplest interpretation is that you can't argue on a decision in the Gemara. When the Gemara says something, it is legally binding for all future generations. And the question is, why? Why is that? The Gemara does not provide an explanation. Now, we might say, well, that's just how it is. You can't argue with the Talmud. One generation can't argue with an earlier generation. Maybe Thomas Paine is wrong. But if you were here probably about a month ago, we actually learned a piece in Rambam that explicitly disagrees with this. So this, in source number 4, is an excerpt from the Rambam's commentary to Maseches Edios, which the Rambam actually referenced in the introduction that we read a few weeks ago. The Rambam was bothered by why the Gemara records minority opinions in the Mishnah, and in the Talmud for that matter. And the question is that if we don't follow them, we have this rule that Yachid v'Rabim halacha k'Rabim. The Rambam said that in every generation you followed the majority opinion. So if that's the case, why does the Mishnah record minority opinions if we don't follow them? So the Rambam answers, quite simply, he says, in future generations, if a court prefers the opinion of a da'as yachid, of a minority opinion, or of a single person, they may follow that, because no court may set aside the decision of another court unless it is greater than it in number and in wisdom. If it was greater than it in wisdom, but not in number but not in wisdom, it may not set aside its decision unless it is greater than it in number and wisdom. So the Rambam says that you can't overturn a ruling of an earlier court unless you're greater in number and in wisdom. If you are, then you can. However, the Rambam also says that when we're not dealing with a law that is legislated by the court, but rather it's an interpretation of a specific verse. In the term that we used a few weeks ago was a pirush, to try to understand a verse. The majority of disputes in the Talmud are basically trying to understand verses in the Torah. The Torah wrote something in a rather vague, ambiguous way, and Hashem gave Moshe different hermeneutical tools. We call them midos, shehatorah nidresh esbahen. There are certain rules that we can use to interpret those verses. And the Rambam says that in future generations, when questions arose as to what the halacha should be, we used those tools to try to explain the verses and to extract what the halacha should be. And the Rambam said that because Hashem didn't tell us what the halacha is, he just gave us the tools to understand it, we can have arguments about it. And in each generation, we follow what the majority interpretation is. However, the Rambam says that in a future generation, if we believe that they got it wrong, we can actually overturn it. We can't overturn a gezeirah or a law that the rabbis created, like muktzah. The rabbi said you can't move an object that the primary purpose is to do work that is forbidden on Shabbos. So you can't move a cell phone on Shabbos. Now, we might say we don't like that law, but we can't undo that because the rabbis came up with that. That's not in the Torah. The rabbis came up with that law, so we can't undo that. But if, for example, there was another verse in the Torah that we only interpreted using these tools that Hashem gave Moshe, and we believe that they got it wrong, we could overturn it. We could say, listen, you got it wrong. So for example, there's a Gzeira Shava. There's a linkage between the word 15 and 15 by Sukkot and Pesach. And there are many halachot that we compare from Sukkot to Pesach. And so we could say, listen, I think you got it wrong. There's really no link between Sukkot and Pesach. I think you're misreading the Pesukim. Because of that, we say that you need to eat in the Sukkah on the first night of Sukkot. If it rains, you have to really wait until very late at night in order to have to eat inside. You really should try to eat outside in the Sukkah on the first night. And we learn that out from that link between Sukkot and Pesach. So if I think that we got it wrong, that there really shouldn't be a link, then theoretically, we could disagree with that. And according to the Rambam, you could be able to do that if you genuinely feel that the rabbis got it wrong. If our generation really feels that the rabbis from the Mishnah and the Talmud got it wrong, we could undo that. And that seems to fly in the face of this Gemara that we just read, that you can't argue with the Gemara. And it seems to fly in the face of what the Rambam himself wrote that we just read, that you can't argue with the Gemara. So the Rambam seems to contradict himself. And the Kesef Mishnah, the author of the Shulchan Aruch, who wrote a commentary on the Rambam, he raises this question and he actually points out that this problem is much bigger than the Rambam. The Rambam definitely says this, but the Kesef Mishnah points out that this problem is not only relegated to the Rambam. It also appears in the Gemara as well. We have a rule that an Amora, a sage from the Gemara, cannot argue with the sage from the Mishnah, cannot argue with the sage called a Tana. And that's why throughout the Gemara, we bring proofs against a position in the Talmud from a Mishnah. And you can't just say, oh, I don't agree with that Mishnah. You need to bring another support from a Mishnaic era sage to buttress your point, because without that, you have to admit defeat. And so the Kesef Mishnah asks, why can't a sage from the Talmud argue with the sage from the Mishnah? Why can't you just say they got it wrong? Why can't you say that? And so the Kesef Mishnah suggests an answer, which is rather ambiguous. He says, "V'efshar lomar, it's possible to say, she'meyimos chasimas ha-Mishnah, that from the time that the Mishnah was sealed, the Mishnah was completed by Rav Yehuda HaNasi, they accepted upon themselves that later generations can't argue with earlier ones." And then he says, perhaps that's the same thing that happens with the Gemara. That when the Gemara was finished, they accepted upon themselves that you can't, that no one has the authority to argue on it. So that's very ambiguous. The Kesef Mishnah just says that the reason why we can't argue with the Talmud and the reason why the Talmud can't argue with the Mishnah is because we decided to. And so the Koves Shiurim, Rav Elchanan Wasserman, you can see his picture over here. Rav Elchanan Wasserman was a rabbi in Lithuania right before World War II. He actually came to America as Hitler was growing in power, and they urged him not to return But he refused. He said he needed to be with his students during this tough time. He returned. He was with his students, and eventually he was killed by Lithuanian Nazi sympathizers. His yard site was actually a few days ago. And on the English calendar, it is July 6th. So our learning is, as should be for an aliyah for his neshama. And so he actually wrote a whole mini pamphlet on this topic. I suspect it was motivated by arguments of the reform movement about the authoritativeness of the Talmud. And he basically says, I don't understand what the Kesef Mishnah is talking about. He says, what does it mean that there was this acceptance? Where does the power come from? Where do we have the power to just accept something and say that no other generation can undo it? Well, maybe that generation can decide to undo it. And so Rav Elchanan Wasserman suggests that perhaps there was a qualitative difference between those particular times in Jewish history by the sealing of the Mishnah and the sealing of the Talmud than in all subsequent generations in Jewish history. He said perhaps that they had the authority to argue with the Mishnah at those points because all of the Jewish sages were working together. And when all the Jewish sages work together, they have the authority of the Jewish Supreme Court, which can overturn things. But between those times, and certainly after the time of the Gemara, not all of the Jewish sages were together, and they did not have the authority of the Supreme Court. That is a suggestion that Rav Elchanan Wasserman offers. And many people take issue with that. They said, first of all, this is a new concept that Rav Elchanan Wasserman is innovating, that he tries to provide support, but it is a very big legal innovation to say that all of the rabbis, when they gather together, have the authority of the Supreme Court. And once you do that, you're now able to argue on future generations. It is a legal innovation. He wasn't the first to come up with that. It was actually started about 500 years before that, when they tried to reinvent the smicha after the Spanish Inquisition in Tzfas. But not everybody agrees with that. And then second of all, there's also the historical issue, which is that Rav Elchanan Wasserman offers no historical support that specifically at those times, all of the sages happened to be together and collaborate together. We just don't have any record of it. He might be right, he might be wrong, but we just don't know. And so it's a little tenuous to try to suggest something based off of a historical reality that we have absolutely no proof of. So perhaps I would say the most accepted answer is based on a responsa of the Rivash. The Rivash was a Spanish rabbi that lived in the late 1300s. He was a student of Rabbeinu Yonah, and basically a grand student of the Ramban. His Rebbe's Rebbe, I believe, was the Ramban. So he actually quotes the Ramban from a work which we no longer have, or at least I don't think we have it. It's called Mishpat HaChayrim, which is a halacha book about vows and prohibiting things. And so the Ramban says, Shekein hadin b'chol kabbalas harabim shachala aleihem ve'al zaram. The Ramban says that any time that a community accepts upon themselves something, it is binding not on only that generation, but on all future generations of that community. So if that community is a particular town, then it's binding on all future generations in that town. And if it's the entire Jewish people that accept something, then it's binding on all future generations of Jews. And he provides a proof for that. He says, "Ki da'ashkechan b'kabbalas haTorah," as we find by Kabbalas haTorah. The Jewish people accepted the Torah at Har Sinai. We didn't accept it. There is a medrash that we were there in spirit, but to call a spade, the Torah doesn't say that we accepted it. There's no record in the Torah that I accepted the Torah. It's only the Jews that were alive then. And the Ramban says the reason why it's binding is because when an entire community accepts something upon themselves, it is binding on all future generations of that community. And that's the reason why he says why we do Megillah, why we fast nowadays. As all of those things are what are called Kabbalas HaRabim, things that the community accepts upon themselves. And when they accept it on themselves, it is actually binding in perpetuity for all future generations. And That's what people typically say to explain what the Kesef Mishnah meant. The reason why we can't argue on the Talmud, or why the Talmud can't argue on the Mishnah, even though technically according to the Rambam, as we said, you are allowed to in many cases, anything involving a biblical interpretation that was not given to us by God, but that we came up with using tools, we can argue with technically. But for various historical, cultural, and sociological reasons, at certain junctures in Jewish history, we accepted on ourselves to not argue with an earlier era in Jewish learning. And that is binding for all future generations. Now the obvious question is why? This is the what? This is the legal mechanism. But what's the reason behind it? So to that, I see it's getting late, so I don't want to keep you in complete suspense. So I'll say it quickly now, and then God willing, next week we'll continue in greater detail because it is a longer piece. This is an excerpt from a drasha in the Sefer Beis Yishai by Rabbi Shlomo Fisher. I believe he's still alive. He's not a young man now, and I don't think he's particularly well. However, he is the Rosh Yeshiva of the Itri Yeshiva in Israel. He's on the left, you can see in the picture. He wears a strimal. He's part of the Yishuv HaYashan, the old Yerushalmi community, but nevertheless, he's a very interesting man. He is extremely well-learned, not only in halacha, but also Kabbalah philosophy, Jewish philosophy, secular philosophy, and he has ties with Jews throughout especially the Orthodox spectrum, even the more Mizrahi or Datilumi, the more Zionist community, as you can see from this picture. And so he basically posited an idea, which is connected to something that it was written by Edmund Burke in response to Thomas Paine. Edmund Burke was a British conservative who saw the horrors of the French Revolution that occurred several decades later. And he wrote to try to respond to Thomas Paine's argument. And they both said something rather similar. I'll just go down to it here. He says, Rabbi Shlomo Fisher says, the Torah of the Jewish people has a character of mishpat, a legalistic culture. And the foundation of a legalistic culture is covenant, is a bris. Now, a bris, a covenant, is something that requires a kabbalas harabim, that requires an acceptance. Now, the question is, why did God want to create a commitment? He says, Ela kach haya ritzono yisparach, litein letorah ofishal mishpat, u'mishpat kayadua mitboses al brit, haynu kabbalat harabim. Rather, God wanted to give the Torah a character of mishpat, and mishpat is founded on a covenant of communal acceptance. As an example, he says, dina de malchusa dina, that the obligation to follow the laws of a government, basically what Thomas Paine was arguing, says, you want to know why it's legally binding? Is because we accept it on ourselves. It is communal acceptance that is the foundation of the Torah itself. But then he says, why? Why is that? Why did God want to create the Torah with an ofishel mishpat of a legalistic nature? Why did God want that? So again, I will go back to this in greater detail later on, but here's his answer. He says that HaTorah HaKedosha Eina Torat HaPrat. The Torah is not a Torah for individuals. Ela Torat HaKlal. It is a Torah for a community. Haklal dahainu klal ha'uma ha'yisraelit, for the entire Jewish nation. V'hu b'emet inyan nifla, shumah shleima, nashim nashim v'taf, chachamim misichlim, kulam hem goy kadosh. It's something wondrous that an entire nation of men, women, children, wise people, fools, kulam hem goy kadosh, they're all equal. V'chal echad v'echad miyisrael hu ever b'shur komat knesses Yisrael. And each Jew, no matter what they are, no matter who they are, no matter where they come from, is part of a single organism of God's divine presence of the Shekhinah. It's a Kabbalistic reference. But essentially, we all comprise an integral part of the Jewish nation. And that's the reason why all Jews are responsible for each other. And so what Rav Shlomo Fisher says is that the reason why the Torah was created in a way that required an acceptance of a community, why the Torah is a legalistic culture, The reason is because the Torah is not a Torah for individuals. Judaism is not a religion for an aggregate group of individuals. Judaism is a religion for a national entity. And therefore, when the national entity accepts something on themselves, they're not only accepting it for their generation, because a generation is an aggregate group of people. A nation, a national identity, transcends a particular moment in time. It comprises all future generations as well. And Edmund Burke said something quite similar to that in source number 10. He says, society is indeed a contract. It is a partnership. As the ends of such a partnership cannot be obtained in many generations, it becomes a partnership not only between those who are living, but between those who are living, those who are dead, and those who are to be born. What Edmund Burke is saying in responding to Thomas Paine is that when a group accepts something on themselves, whether it be a town, whether it be a colony, or whether it be an entire nation, they're not accepting it on themselves as a group of individuals. They're accepting it on themselves as part of a national identity. And an identity is something that transcends a particular moment in time and even a particular generation, because the end goal of whatever we're accepting on ourselves cannot be accomplished in one generation. God's plan for humanity with giving us the Torah could not be completed in one generation of the Jews in the desert. In fact, they all died out. We needed a whole new generation just to get into the land of Israel. And now for thousands of years, we're in exile. And we're praying for the Beis HaMikdash so we can finally complete God's work. But everything that has happened in Jewish history is part of this mission that we've been entrusted with from our parents and our grandparents and all the generations of Jews that came before that. And so therefore, whenever a group accepts something on themselves in Jewish history, they're not only accepting it on themselves, they're accepting it as part of being Jewish, as part of the Jewish mission, which exists for all future time. And so therefore, we can't argue with the Talmud why. Technically, according to the Rambam, we are able to. The reason is because we decided we aren't, we can't, we don't want to. And that decision, because it was accepted by all of the Jewish people, it doesn't mean they all just decided one day, okay, we put it to a vote. What it means, and what Rosalmo Fisher elaborates, is that this was just an evolving historical trend that people did not just decided, listen, I don't feel comfortable arguing with the Talmud. And once that became the modus operandi in the Torah world, that was essentially de facto accepted by the people then. And therefore, it became binding in all future generations. So I do want to stop here to give everybody the opportunity to watch the fireworks. And so, God willing, we will continue with this next week, which means we'll probably need another week to just finish the series after that as well. But I want to wish you all a happy rest of July 4th. And when you look at the fireworks, or if you have any other types of celebrations, and you think about Thomas Paine, that in Judaism, we do believe something different. We believe that perhaps in the secular world, you can break away from a government if you believe that the government is unjust, that a revolution is justified. But when it comes to Torah, and perhaps the American enterprise as well, whatever the American dream and the American enterprise stands for, it's a multi-generational odyssey. And therefore, we're a link, a critical link in the chain of continuing that. So I want to wish you a happy July 4th, a happy week, even though this is the Bein HaMitzarim. God willing, we will see the Beis HaMikdash soon, and look forward to learning with you next week. All righty, take care.
Thank you.